Greetings. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And we are Building Bridges.
We'll speak with Professor Vivek Chhibber about his new book, Confronting Capitalism and How the World Works and How to Change It.
Let's hear what Barbara Dane now has to say about, well, the capitalist system.
Capitalist system, and I'll tell you the reason why it has caused me so much suffering and my dearest friends to die. Well, I know you all are wondering what it has done to me. Well, I am going to tell you that my husband has TB, brought on by hard work and low wages and never enough to eat from going cold and hungry with no shoes upon his feet. My husband was a coal miner who worked hard and risked his life just trying to support three children, himself, his mother and wife. Well, I had a blue-eyed baby, was a darling of my heart. But from my little darling, her mother had to part. While the rich and mighty capitalist goes dressed in jewels and silk, my darling blue-eyed baby has died for the want of milk. Well,
so I hate the capitalist system, written and sung by the great Barbara Dane.
Vivek Chhibber, professor of sociology at New York University, editor of Catalyst, a journal of theory and strategy, and the author of Confronting Capitalism, How the World Works and How to Change It, joins us, and with that splendid introduction by Barbara Dane, I Hate the Capitalist System, to get us started.
What better way than to bring in Professor Chhibber, who is, what I want to know is, Professor, and we're riffing off of his wonderful, important new book, a primer on confronting capitalism, how the world works and how to change it. Professor, what is baked into the capitalist system, or what I refer to as plantation capitalism, the system of production that evolved from slave labor and with its methods of control of its sweated labor, i.e. its ideology of white supremacy and hierarchy, and its policing apparatus to these days? Now, wage slavery that makes Barbara Dane and yourself in your new book want to confront the capitalist system. Why is it hopelessly, irreparably impaired and the immiseration of the working class? And so much, thank you for writing the book. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Your question was, what is baked into the system? And what's baked into the system is a very simple principle, which is a relentless, remorseless pursuit of profit by capitalist firms at the expense of whatever else gets in their way, including the well-being, the welfare of the vast majority of the population. In the old days, they used to call it profit before people. And that's the essential principle. That basically you can describe the essence of capitalism in that one sentence. What that ends up doing is, because employers seek profit before everything else, they look at their labor force, their workers, as a means, as something, as an instrument, which they're going to deploy the same way that they deploy machines or anything else. And that means you run those machines, you run those people as fast and as hard as you can, and you try to do it at the best possible value for yourself, which is the lowest wages that you can get away with. Now, that doesn't mean slave wages or sweatshop wages for everyone. Different sectors with different productivities will have different wages, and higher productivity sectors will have higher wages. But the point is that the employer will try to squeeze that wage down to the lowest that he can get away with. That still is consistent with wage differentiation, but it means that every employer is at war with his employees every day, every week, every month of the year. That class warfare is built into the system, and it comes about because of the relentless pursuit of profit. That's basically it. That's capitalism.
But I'm going to protest, and it's going to change, and we're going to reform things. Are we not?
Yeah, and you can. It's obviously not unreformable, because over the course of the 20th century, you went from these smokehouses with 14-hour, 16-hour work days, and where the average life expectancy of a worker was 32 years before they fell dead, you've gone to a system in which we do have some things like state-provided health insurance in many countries, unemployment insurance, life expectancy has gone up, you do have labor protections. All of that came from the struggles of working people. It's not that capitalism cannot be reformed. It's that as long as you're in capitalism, those reforms have to, A, come through bloody and relentless struggle of working people. And secondly, they're always precarious because capital never sleeps, and they're always going to be trying to roll them back. And in the last 40 years or so, across the US, across Europe, across the global South, has been an era where hard-fought victories and reforms have been rolled back to the point where most working people don't have any confidence in the state anymore, in public provision, in public goods, or even in government institutions. And that's why they've become sort of open to messages from the far right.
How do we organize not only to change, but to transcend this system and bring about a new system? How do we organize?
Well, the actual organizing to transcend the system has not historically been very different from the organizing to change within the system. So if you look at the countries where you had successful revolutions 100 years ago or 80 years ago, those were countries in which the lead in the revolutionary struggle was taken up either by workers' organizations like trade unions or by peasant organizations, much like the peasant organizations you've had in the second half of the 20th century. So the organizing tasks are not that different. And even when revolution doesn't seem to be on the agenda, and it certainly is not on the agenda anywhere today, the task of organizing for revolutionaries is much the same as it is for people fighting for reforms, which is you build trade unions that are fighting organizations, that take on the employer, that bring working people together regardless of gender or race or ethnicity, and which see their main task as engaging in economic warfare with the people who exploit them. Even if you are just a social democrat, if you're serious about social democracy, that's how social democracy came about too, through bloody, violent, long class struggle.
We are speaking with Professor Vivek Chibber, Confronting Capitalism, How the World Works and How to Change It. One of the questions that perhaps it's a sequel to the book, but isn't capitalism endlessly resilient, able to pull lots of rabbits out of its seemingly bottomless magic hat, such that we've seen the decimation, the dismantling of the Soviet Union? We've seen the further bureaucratization, democratic centralism, more centralism than democracy in China and the like. So why is it that we hate the capitalist system and cannot harness that to really resource the working people of the world who create the wealth, as opposed to fighting and working for a better world, i.e. socialism?
Yes, it's resilient. It's extremely resilient, because what capitalism does is it puts everyone in a position where they have to put their own interests above everyone else's. Nobody has to tell them to do this. Nobody has to teach them this in school. Nobody has to indoctrinate them ideologically. So if you look at people who run the firms and the banks, they have to put the interests of profit making above everything else. Otherwise, they lose their job or their firms go under. You can't be a philanthropic capitalist all the way down, because even if you try to do the right thing, if doing the right thing means you put the interests of society above your profits, your competitor will beat you and you'll be driven out of the market. So sooner or later, the only capitalists who remain are more or less the ones who are willing to play the game. Now you look at the other side, the workers. What's their situation? Well, they have to find a job and hold on to it, whether they're black, brown, woman, man, anything. Finding a job and holding on to it is priority number one, because without that, you can't do anything else in your life. Finding a job means competing with other people. First, to acquire the job, then to hold on to it within the firm, because the boss pits you against all the other workers to see who's the most productive, and he gets rid of the ones who were the least productive. So you're constantly now fighting your other fellow workers for yourself. Nobody has to tell you that. Nobody has to teach you that. There's no indoctrination. That's what you have to do. Socialism and the fight for socialism is something very different. Bare bottom, whatever else it is, people have to come together and consciously build a culture for themselves where they sacrifice for each other and they fight for each other, not just for themselves, but for each other. Because if you just fight for yourself, your organization falls apart. That means that you have a fight in which one side is doing the simplest thing imaginable, which is just looking out for number one, and the other side has to constantly build a culture for itself of solidarity and community against the corrosive forces of the market. That gives the ruling class an edge over the working class every time in every battle. That's what gives it its resilience. Now, keep in mind, to address the other side of your question, the fight against capitalism is quite young. In most of the world, it started only about 40 or 50 years ago. And by that, I mean much of the global South, where you've had decolonization. The first fight was to attain independence. And the second fight was then within that independence to take on your own ruling class, your own capitalists and your own landlords to try to fight for something better. It's a very, very, very young fight. And the capitalism itself is hundreds of years old. So I wouldn't get too pessimistic just yet. It's just that we've lived through 50 of the worst years in the whole modern era, and that will make anybody despondent.
And we have to say this is an extraordinary book on the dynamics and politics of capitalism, but it is brilliantly written. It is accessible. It is able to be internalized. And I wonder, Professor, if you would grace us with a reading of a passage from the book, because after all, it's about confronting capitalism, how the world works and how to change it, and using its instruction. So do give us a reading from your marvelous book.
I kind of thought, Mimi, that you were going to choose a passage.
But... I did. And I emailed. But maybe we can just start with the from the beginning that sets the frame. And
well, let me read to you a passage, which I think speaks to at least the motivation for the book.
Wonderful.
And which will tell people what it's about. What I say in the introduction is that here's the passage. This book is intended to contribute to the development of the incipient left. One of the most glaring weaknesses of the current culture is the dearth of clear and simple introductions to the basic dynamics of capitalism. When the socialist movement was at its peak during the interwar years, intellectuals associated with communist parties, socialist organizations, and trade unions produced a rich corpus of pamphlets and short booklets intended to serve as pedagogical tools and organizing aids. This practice even carried over into the new left, even though it was less robust. But by the 1980s, it was a dying art. This was no doubt because of the processes that I examine in this book, chief amongst which was not just the defeat of the organized left, but more importantly, the complete takeover of radical discourse by the professional classes, academics and nonprofits. Radical theory became less concerned with disseminating and popularizing its advances and turned inward toward the professional concerns of those producing it. It became ever more abstruse, apolitical, and ultimately pessimistic about the very possibility of political transformation.
Well, that is one of the ones I picked for sure.
Oh, okay. Great.
Professor Chibber, I just wonder if you might be able to go beyond the reform stage and give us a taste of the kinds of things that might be apparent in a new social order, a new socialism. I know that there are many things that we can try to change in reforming capitalism, but what would a new society look like?
Well, there are two models of new societies that the left has sort of worked with since Marx's time. The first, of course, is to abolish the market altogether, because the market, as I said earlier, pits us against each other and forces us to put money and prices in above all other things. So the idea was that in order to have a truly humane society, we need to replace the market with a kind of a society of cooperative association in which planning takes the many of the tasks that market allocation used to do. We saw some attempt at this in the Soviet Union, where you had what was called a centrally planned economy. And in the China during the Maoist era, where they tried to have planning, and of course in parts of Eastern Europe and Cuba as well. That's one model. The other model has been one where you don't so much abolish the market as so much abolish private property, but you retain the market in many spheres. So now you would have either a marketized society, but in which there's no private ownership. So one way to do that might be the state owns everything, but firms compete against each other in order to be viable. The difference here is that there's no plan telling them what to do, and the firms don't retain all their profits. A big chunk of it gets taxed away. They share the rest of it amongst the workers. There are many ways to do that, but you don't have central planning. Another model of market socialism is where you don't have markets for everything. One section of the economy will be state-run and planned, say big chunks like the utilities, transportation, education, and then parts that are harder to plan, like consumer services, restaurants, small shops. You would leave those to the market, but again, without private ownership. So in all forms of market socialism, you do away with, or at least minimize, private ownership. But in all forms of market socialism, you don't have complete planning. You have some role for the market. They differ from centrally planned economy in that the centrally planned economies were at least trying to expand the domain of planning as much as possible, even to the extent of doing away with markets altogether. Those are the two basic models of socialism. What we know is that the attempts at central planning didn't work. Maybe they could in the future. I am quite skeptical that they ever could. We do know that some kind of state planning in a limited way is very much possible because it's been done even in capitalism. So to my mind, we can quite realistically say that a very advanced form of social democracy is possible. It's not post-capitalism, but it is a very, very humanized form of capitalism. And we think some kind of market socialism ought to be possible because it's not going to be that much of a leap beyond what we've seen accomplished within capitalism. Planned economies are a whole different problem.
Well, one of the things that we see now is perhaps the extent of the neoliberalism butting up against its aspiration to world hegemony And yet, on the other hand, we see the growth of worldwide populism, indeed neo-fascism, if not demonstrative fascism. And we're not able to tackle that whole question, but get us started, which your book certainly does, on the road to organization to continue the process of dismantling those walls of Jericho, which can come tumbling down, the brutality, the viciousness of the capitalist system. What kinds of organizations? You seem to intimate that it is still working at the seat of production and with an electoral arm, a party and a labor movement. Is that where you're taking us to begin to reach that beloved community, that anti-capitalist community that Martin Luther King referred to?
Yeah, that to me, as long as you're in capitalism, two things are going to be eternally true. One is capital, the owners of capital are going to call the shots, not because of their gender, not because of their race, not because of their ethnicity, but because they own capital. They run the means of production. They control investment. So you've got to make capital the focus of your struggles, not to the exclusion of everything else. But if you don't go up against capital, what you can accomplish is extremely limited in any domain, not just on the class domain, but in the race and gender domain as well. So that's point number one. Point number two is that what the other thing that's going to be eternally true is that if you're going up against capital, the only thing capital fears is labor. It does not fear the army. It does not fear the state. It controls both of those things. It fears labor. So that means the road to some kind of more humane, civilized order is going to go through the labor movement. I do not see any way around that. No other kind of organizing, no other kind of political strategy is going to have the payoff that organizing the working class does. Now, that's also kind of a good thing because it just so happens it means that you have to organize and gain the support of the vast majority of the population, because the vast majority of the population everywhere is workers. That will automatically force you to be a democratic movement. You're not going to do it through conspiracies, through coups, through tiny little grouplets substituting themselves for the majority. You're going to have to do it through the majority's assent. How you do that, now that requires some flexibility. It's indubitably true that the capitalism today does not look like the capitalism of the smokestacks and the River Rouge plant employing tens of thousands of workers and manufacturing being at the core of the economy. It is a capitalism in which the profit motive still reigns supreme, but where you have a huge role for services, which you didn't before, a bigger role for finance, which you didn't before, and new forms of labor. So that means even though you're organizing labor, is going to take different tactics and different institutions than you had before, different kinds of day-to-day tactics than you had before. But as I said earlier, it's still going to have to be a trade. You might give it a different name, but it's going to function like a trade union, because if you're bringing workers together, you're going to bring them together against their boss. That's the essence of what a trade union is. So the first thing I see is the union movement. And second, as you said, Mimi, I do not think you can avoid electoral politics. It's just that the electoral politics can't substitute for or go on without real muscle in the workplace and in the economy.
Well, just finally, the issue of, for example, in Mississippi, in Jackson, there are more and more workers' centers that are springing up. They do not look like, and they're not going to your typical efforts to unionize and get a contract. And that's without discussing how parochial at best and lacking in democracy too many of our unions are. And that's not about repudiating unions. It's just understanding the work that needs to take place in the union sector. But in the place for community organization of the working class around democratic rights issues, issues of police violence, issues of gun violence, issues of control over women's reproductive functions and the likes, against the terrifying repression and oppression of LGBTQIA people, which seems to be a major force historically, all these areas for democratizing and bringing people together, both forcing reforms and having a direct role in saying, I hate the capitalist system. This form of state organization is what causes the repression. Your thoughts on the community sector?
Well, this can become kind of a cliche on the left, and we really want to try to avoid just checking the boxes and, you know, virtue signaling. So we have about, there are two ways to look at these community centers, these worker centers. One is historically, they weren't called worker centers, but every single major working class movement had a presence outside the workplace, in neighborhoods, in communities, fulfilling many of the services that we today associate with worker centers. So to me, it's inconceivable that you have a powerful working class movement which confines itself to simply the workplace. The reason is, every time you go out on strike, unless you have support and some kind of institutional mechanisms in the community to counter the horrible destitution and the sacrifice that working people have to take up while they're on strike, the strike's going to fail. Every time, everywhere, it took enormous organizing outside the workplace to sustain the fight within the workplace. So, yes.
Well, arriving, you have, just at the time when we are tempered by despair, confronting capitalism brilliantly illuminates our current predicament and guides us towards the only way out. So you must read it, and we must continue and will this conversation, will we not, Professor?
Yep. Absolutely, anytime you want.
We have been speaking with Professor Vivek Chibber, confronting capitalism, how the world works, and how to change it, because we're all about educating, agitating, and organizing for a better world as possible, and we are the ones to make it so, with a little help from our friends like Vivek Chibber. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Professor. And organize, organize, organize. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nashman.
Building Bridges.